The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning. You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis. Coming up on the Best of the Book Nook, we're going to go back 25 years to a book by John DeGraff. Of the four books he's written, this was the one that was a bestseller. It sold over 160,000 copies. It's been translated into 9 languages. And it's the story of us. It's called Affluenza. Are you suffering from affluenza? Well, 25 years ago, I wasn't, and I'm not now, but a lot of people still are. And we'll be talking all about affluenza. And do you know what that means? It's coming up in the Book Nook right after the news. Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. We're going to go back 25 years to an interview I did on October 5th, 2001 with a guy named John DeGraff. He had a book out called Affluenza. It was a bestseller, and John is known mostly as a documentary filmmaker. In fact, Affluenza was a PBS special, and he made a dozen PBS specials over his career. So far, he's still making documentary films. And we talked to him back in 2001 about this mysterious affliction he called affluenza.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and joining us on the program today is John DeGraff. He is the co-author of a book called Affluenza, the All-Consuming Epidemic. He joins us by telephone from Seattle. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Good to be here.
Now, John, I seem to have a vague recollection of a television program by this name.
You have a recollection, that's correct. The book actually came from a television program, sort of the opposite of the way things normally go. But I was the co-producer of the PBS special Affluenza and its follow-up Escape from Affluenza, which first aired in 1997.
Now, affluenza, that sounds like some kind of a disease.
It is, you know, and it's only half tongue-in-cheek. I mean, obviously, it's a sort of composite word putting together affluence and influenza, and that's the idea that this is an epidemic, a kind of a virus, if you will, of overconsumption that is having all kinds of impacts on our health, our communities and families, and on the environment. And we look at the symptoms much as you would symptoms of influenza, but show how, in fact, they exist in this disease, and it's only partly in jest because I've actually had doctors who've written to me or called me after seeing the TV show initially, and they said, you know, this affluenza is actually kind of a real thing. We've got patients who, up to half our patients, have physical complaints that when we really diagnose where they come from the stress and all the other things that are caused by trying to keep up with the Joneses and consume. And for their therapy, we actually get them to sit down and watch the film or now maybe read the book as actual treatment. So affluenza, you know, we use the term in jest, but it's really serious as well.
Well, isn't affluenza really the thing that keeps our economy chugging right along?
Well, it is to a degree. I mean, unfortunately, we are kind of have a kind of an addictive economy in that we really are dependent on sort of constant growth in order to keep the economy going and constant spending and so forth, at least the way it currently works. But I don't think it has to be that way. I think some of the European countries are beginning to show how we can turn away from that and take some of these increases that we have in productivity in the form of more time and more leisure rather than in the form always of more stuff. We can spread the work that exists out, and we don't just have to constantly produce and consume more and we can still have a healthy economy.
Now, John, I've often thought that with all the work that's gone on in the past, our forebears, our parents, that by now we shouldn't have to work at all. I've been kind of disappointed by that.
Well, you know, just to kind of show you how old I am, I was in college in the 60s, and at that time I studied sociology, and the big deal was then, everybody was talking about, was this sort of coming age of automation. Well, automation was already here, but cybernation with computers and all these kinds of things. And what they said was this was going to create this leisure society, and that by the year 2000, we'd all be working an average of maybe 15, 20 hours a week, and we would, quote, have so much leisure time, we wouldn't know what to do with it. In fact, that was going to be the big social problem that sociologists had to worry about at the end of the 20th century. But the opposite has actually happened, and we are, in fact, working more hours. The average worker is working more hours each year right now than they were in 1969 in the United States. We're the workaholics of the world. We passed Japan for that dubious honor in 1999. And what's happened is that we have taken these tremendous increases in productivity, at least a doubling of productivity since the 50s, and instead of taking time off, we've put all those gains into producing more stuff and none of the gains into more leisure.
I'm reminded of the old saying, pride goes before a fall. I see a lot of pride involved here. We're very proud of our country. We call ourselves the greatest country in the world. We're proud of our work ethic. We're proud of our brand new home, our beautiful car, our lovely facelift. This is about pride.
Yes, it is. And so in that sense, it's about really non-material things. And what we've gotten into is a pattern where we have been taught, I think, through advertising and through many other things, that we can meet non-material needs with material products, when actually what we want is to feel proud, we want to feel useful, we want to feel esteem. And psychologists and religious people together both, scientists tell us that this comes far more from having healthy family relationships, from being involved in one's community, from having a sense of contribution in what one does, and it doesn't come nearly as effectively in the sense of piling up stuff as a display for others.
The book is Affluenza, the All-Consuming Epidemic. In the book, you make the point that Jimmy Carter was really the last sitting president who seemed to have a clue about the danger of affluenza, and you point out some quotes from former Vice President Al Gore that indicated that he had a clue about it as well, but something changed with him.
Well, yeah, I think Al Gore really got it. I mean, at one time, he wrote a wonderful book back in 1992 called Earth in the Balance, and people may not remember that book. He was still a senator. This was right before he became vice president. And in that book, he warned about our idea that just consuming things could make us happy, and he also warned about the terrible damage that this emphasis on growth and on more and more stuff causes to the environment. And I don't know what happened. I say in the book it's kind of like some kind of mind snatcher came and took Al Gore. In 1992, when Gore and Clinton sat on the stage for their inauguration ceremony in Washington, D.C., they asked to have a song sung at the inauguration, and a soprano with a wonderful voice sang that. It's called Simple Gifts, and it basically it's a gift to be simple, a gift to be free. It's a song about living simply without stuff, and I have film of that in the Affluenza documentary, the TV documentary, with Clinton and Gore both nodding to the theme of this music. But in fact, when they got in, they just simply vowed to grow the economy faster than their opponents, and so have all has everybody since then. When Gore debated Jack Kemp in 1996 in the vice presidential debates, Jack Kemp said he wanted to double the size of the U.S. economy in 15 years, and Gore never questioned whether Americans really it would be a good thing for them to consume twice as much as they do now. And in the last election, when Gore debated Bush, Gore himself suggested that within 10 years he would increase the size of the U.S. economy by 30%. So he's kind of caught up in this addiction. I don't know what happened, except I guess the way money influences politics, in the sense that if one wants to run for these high offices, one has to say the kind of things that will get the corporate dollars.
You're listening to the best of the Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, fact-based journalism in service of democracy. And going back 25 years to an interview I did with a guy named John DeGraff, his only appearance on the program, to talk about his bestseller, Affluenza. And bear in mind, this was recorded on October 5th, 2001, just a few weeks after 9/11. We'll continue with this interview right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO. Back in 2001, I interviewed John DeGraff for his bestseller, Affluenza. And I thought it was a very timely book 25 years ago. And frankly, I still do.
This strikes me as a very timely book, John, because clearly we're in a situation right now where barometers from Wall Street, like consumer confidence, are things that are getting people very alarmed. We have our president telling us, get out there, fly, go on vacations, go to New York City.
Yeah, it's your patriotic duty.
Yeah, yeah. And this is clearly a very powerful issue to consume. We have to get that economy going again.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is, and it's been something that, with the exception of Jimmy Carter, and when way back right after World War II, the exception of Harry Truman, virtually every U.S. president has told us to do. It's your patriotic duty to consume, buy, spend, grow the economy. And, you know, I think that we just have to ask ourselves, is that putting us in a direction where we ultimately want to go? If we don't say we don't consume, we don't go out and we don't spend, then companies feel like, okay, we're going to have a recession, so we have to lay off 10-20% of our workforce because we've lost that much of a market. Now, what if, on the other hand, they looked at it a different way, like many U.S. companies did during the Great Depression, and they said, instead of laying off 10 or 20% of the workforce and throwing those people completely out on their own with no job at all, they reduced the work week for everybody by one day, so that people worked a four-day week. They spread out the work that existed, and they paid somewhat less to the people who were working less because they were working less. I think what you would see at first would be some grumbling from the workers because they'd lost a little bit of salary, but nobody would be thrown out in the cold. And I predict that soon people would start to say, hey, I like having a little more free time. And even if I could have the salary back, I wouldn't want to work those extra hours.
Wouldn't it be nice to get home with enough time to maybe do a little gardening or just kind of sit out there outside and enjoy nature? Wouldn't that be a good thing?
It'd be great. And, you know, time for the family and community to volunteer, time for learning things. Some people say, and I've heard this argument many times, I get this question when I speak. They say, well, geez, you know, given Americans and what they do with their time, if you gave people more time right now, they'd just use it spending watching television. You know, they just take the time, they'd go sit in front of the tube.
Uh-huh.
But actually, the facts show that the opposite is true. There's a direct correlation between the amount of time that people work in a given year on average in a country and the amount of time they spend watching television in the same year. And the correlation is that the more hours people work in any country, the more hours they spend watching television. That seems counterintuitive, but actually, if you think about it, it's not. When people have time and when they're not all tired out from work, they don't have to come home and veg out, turn on the TV because they're too exhausted to do anything else. They have both the time and the energy to go out, meet with other people, do things with other people, do hobbies, read, and do other things, and they actually watch less TV.
The book is Affluenza, and we've been joined by John DeGraff. He wrote it along with David Wan and Thomas Naylor. It's recently been published by Barrett Kohler Publishers out of San Francisco. If you can't find the book in your local bookstore, they do have a website. It's bkconnection.com. And this book really gave me some food for thought. I enjoyed consuming what was in the book. You have some great quotes, including some from some odd sources to start most of the chapters. One I really liked was from a New Yorker cartoon from 1993, where apparently the cartoon caption was, "I was sad because I had no onboard fax until I saw a man who had no mobile phone."
Yeah, and of course that's a play off the old line that I think came from Gandhi, who said, "I was sad because I had no shoes until I saw a man who had no feet." And this is just kind of taking it a step up, and it's part of our chapter called Swollen Expectations, and that, you know, just constantly our expectations of what we need for a good life are increasing, and we're told that we always have to have more, that the computer you have this year isn't good enough next year, the TV set isn't big enough, the Palm Pilot doesn't have all the extra features. It's one thing after another. There's no end to it, and we're always told we need a better, faster, bigger, shinier, and more exciting model. But we're paying a tremendous cost in health and in our environment and everything for this obsession with newer and better.
You also have a great quote from Lily Tomlin. "We buy a wastebasket and take it home in a plastic bag. Then we take the wastebasket out of the bag and put the bag in the wastebasket."
That speaks for itself, I think. Yeah, Lily Tomlin's funny, and I don't have any wisdom to add to that one. I think it speaks for itself.
Now, John, yesterday I was getting listeners ready for this interview, and I actually read all the questions on the Affluenza self-diagnosis test, and I found this to be very enlightening.
Oh, good. It's also meant to be humorous and somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but there is certainly a serious vein to it, and the idea behind it is that you can kind of find out your temperature and see how bad you've got the disease and how much work you need to try to get over it.
Now, the role of public relations really comes into this. I've had John Stauber on the program, who keeps a close eye on the PR industry. Public relations is such an art in this country. Most of the time, we're not even aware that it's going on. It's done so well, and it is really a key element in our whole worldview, from our lack of knowledge about issues like global warming to our desire for new products.
Well, I agree, and you know, there's a huge multi-billion-dollar industry out there who's basically trying to convince us that up is down and white is black, and that we don't need to worry about things like global warming or the hole in the ozone or consuming too much or, you know, wasting resources, whatever it is, because there's always going to be plenty. And this is an industry that's very well funded with corporate dollars, and John Stauber does a much better job of looking at that, I think, in his book Trust Us, We're Experts, or his other book Toxic Sludge Is Good for You, than we do. He really takes it in depth, but it's part of persuading us that this particular lifestyle that we've got can just go on forever and we don't have to worry about it. But scientists around the world who study these things in depth are saying, well, wait a minute, if indeed the rest of the world were to try to adopt the United States lifestyle, which we put out as a model for other countries, if that were to happen, we would need anywhere from 4 to 6 planets to actually have the resources and other things to make that possible, so that we're about 3 to 5 planets short, depending on, you know, which figures you look at. So this PR industry is, I think, blinding us to some very serious problems that lie on the horizon, and that at the very least we as a country need to begin to talk about seriously and not leave to 30-second commercials. I mean, I see the new ones for biotechnology, for this, for that. In 30 seconds they tell you that biotechnology will save the world, or that, you know, global warming doesn't matter. One of them said, you know, it's even better because if it gets hotter, we'll grow more plants. And I mean, it's pretty crazy stuff. But we need a dialogue. We don't need 30-second sound bites and commercials.
Now, when you did your PBS piece, Affluenza, you were in contact with that group out of Vancouver that makes the commercials that aren't really commercials. And wasn't there an issue about running one of those on the program?
Well, not on our program, but on commercial television. The group is called Adbusters, and they produce what they call uncommercials that kind of poke fun at consuming and its environmental impacts. There's wonderful stuff that they do, and they have tried. They've actually had the money to try to buy airtime on commercial networks to show these counter ads, these uncommercials. And to date, only CNN has allowed them to buy any time whatsoever, and that's been somewhat minimal, but at least CNN has done it. The major networks have not allowed them to buy any time at all. I showed several of the ads in the Affluenza documentary on PBS, and I think it does indicate, I don't want to be a promoter, but public television is the place where you can see some of these kinds of things that just will not get on the commercial networks. When Affluenza, the TV show, first came on, we had a review in People magazine, and one of the things that review said was, this is a program that kind of proves the PBS adage, if not PBS where, because there isn't a commercial network around that would touch this program with a 10-foot pole without they'd offend all their advertisers. So I think we need to put far more support into public television and public radio, these kinds of things that are not dependent so much on commercial sponsors.
That was a great plug.
Well, I believe in it. You know, I really do. When you think of how underfunded our public radio and television are compared to other countries, that's just one more thing that we don't know about the rest of the world. For example, public TV in this country, we pay about $1 a year per person in tax dollars for public television. The British, by contrast, pay about $30 a year, and that's why they get all the stuff that the BBC does for them.
And I'm sure you could come up with some similar figures for public radio.
Yeah, I could. I'm a little less familiar with that directly, but I'm a great believer in public radio. My wife is a public radio reporter, and of course Scott Simon, who's a very wonderful public radio personality, was the host for the Affluenza TV documentary, and he also wrote the foreword to the book.
Now, does your wife work for NPR?
No, for the local NPR affiliate in Seattle, one of the local affiliates.
Oh, wow. Small world.
Yep.
I hear someone talking.
I actually started out in radio myself.
Did you? I hear someone talking in the background.
Was that somebody being paged in the station where I work? Sorry about that.
Oh, you're there right now?
Yep.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
My guest is John DeGraff. The book is Affluenza, the All-Consuming Epidemic. You, at the end of the book, actually suggest some things to do if you feel like you're suffering from affluenza. Give our listeners some ideas of some of the things that you recommend.
Well, again, we do this somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but it's serious as well, and we try to follow the model of the flu, of influenza, and what you do. And, of course, the first thing you do when you come down with the flu and you're really sick is you stop. You go to bed. You get some bed rest. Doctor says, you know, take an aspirin, go to bed, et cetera. And so what we call bed rest for affluenza is stopping. Stop buying, sit down, assess, spend a month or so figuring out all the things that you've spent money on, what kind of satisfaction have you gotten for those things, how much of your life energy is going into the work time to buy those things, and are you really getting what you think out of them? Secondly, we suggest what we call aspirin and chicken soup, which is about kind of TLC for affluenza, and that's about getting together with other people, friends and neighbors, in small, what are called simplicity study circles to find out what you can do together to help each other cut back and simplify your lives and share things like tools so that we can take advantage of some of the good things that stuff does bring us. I mean, this is not a book about you know, going down wearing a hair shirt and completely living in abject poverty. We're not suggesting anything like that at all. We're suggesting, though, that some of the good things from material things, everybody on every block doesn't have to have their own. These things can be shared and at the same time create a greater level of community. And we're talking about some of the things one can do is to get out, to volunteer, to spend more time in the natural world. Finally, we go into social and political ways to deal with this problem. We don't think affluenza as a disease can be solved on a purely personal basis. We think this society is pretty affluenza-friendly and that it's simplicity unfriendly and that needs to be reversed. So there are things we can do with taxation, to tax luxury consumption, to penalize waste and reward frugality. There are things we can do to shorten working hours, which we used to do in this country but haven't done since 1938, when many of the European countries are doing it right now. Many things that we can do that will make it easier to live simpler and more fulfilling lives.
One thing that you point out is that community is such a key element here, supporting your local small merchant, trying to avoid the chains, trying to avoid fast food. The quality of life issues are inherent in these types of recommendations. If we can't keep our local communities livable, how can we live in a livable world?
Well, I think that's absolutely true, and it's those kind of interactions and knowing people and having this sort of direct contact and things that make for happier and more fulfilling lives, and they also give us a little more diversity in our lives, which in a way makes lives more interesting. Now, as all of society begins to look alike with the same chains, the same everything everywhere, I mean, ultimately, that's kind of boring. And I think somewhere, subconsciously at least, we realize that. And so we're looking for something that would make life more diverse and more interesting, and we're told that the answer to that is just to go buy new products constantly. But in fact, it might be to go back to making really more diverse and unique communities.
Now, if I could make an observation here, it strikes me that people who are obsessed with more, with consuming, with profit, with making lots of money, don't really consider themselves to be caretakers of nature, that it's more of an aggressive relationship where they have an attitude like, I own this, I will strip mine it, I will cut this down, all in the quest for profit, and what do we have left?
Well, I think there are certainly people who feel that way and who do those things. I think they're a great minority. I mean, I think most Americans do care about the natural world and the environment and nature, and I think polls and other things show that. I think sometimes they're not aware of really what our activities are doing to the world in that sense. But I think particularly young people, the kids, they're very concerned about the earth and the environment that they inherit, and they want to recycle and reuse and think smart about what they're doing to nature, and I think they appreciate it. And there are many places where there are wonderful programs happening in schools and things like that that are giving kids more of a appreciation of the natural world. The state of California, for example, is aiming to have a garden in every elementary school that kids would work on as part of their daily education. I think those kind of things both, you know, get kids more in touch with natural life forces, with working together, and with a little slower pace that's in tune with the natural rhythms of life and not necessarily in tune with Digimon and Pokemon and, you know, the stuff on TV.
I guess these are more public relations issues. I can't remember if it was in your book or another one that I read where you mentioned this fellow out in Northern California who's been clear-cutting all the redwoods so he could buy junk bonds.
Yeah, that's Charles Hurwitz, the CEO of Maxam, which is a big Houston corporation that bought Pacific Lumber Company, also bought Kaiser Aluminum. And he's just been, you know, doing that stuff, clear-cutting his forests of redwoods and because of junk bonds. And But I think that there are people who are turning against this kind of behavior. And for the Charles Hurwitzes that are out there, I've also seen and appreciated corporate leaders who are looking in a different direction. We have a movement now that's called Certified Forestry, the Certified Wood Movement. And we have lumber companies that are really making an effort to harvest timber in a sustainable way, to treat employees fairly, and when they can show that they're really doing that, they get a little certified FSC, it's called, label on their wood. You'll see some of that even in stores like Home Depot. When you see it, it indicates that here's wood that comes from a company that is taking an ecological approach to the forest and a fair approach to communities and their employees.
You're listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO, revisiting an interview I did a quarter of a century ago on October 5th, 2001, with a guy named John DeGraff. He's a documentary filmmaker, and he'd written a bestseller called Affluenza, and we'll bring you the last section of that interview right after this. Closing out the best of the Book Nook on WYSO with an interview I did with John DeGraff back in 2001. Talking about his bestseller, Affluenza.
My guest is John DeGraff. He has written a book called Affluenza, The All-Consuming Epidemic. Tell us about these other gentlemen who wrote the book with you.
Well, Dave Wan is an environmental scientist, teaches part-time at the University of Denver, and he worked for 11 years as an officer in the EPA. In Denver. Thomas Naylor is a former professor of economics where he spent 30 years at Duke University, now still teaches part-time at Middlebury College in Vermont, and has written many books as a consultant to several governments. And so I'm a TV producer, and as such, I don't have a lot of credibility about some of these issues, but I think having David's expertise where the environment is concerned, and Thomas with an impeccable track record as an economist who can say, this isn't just sort of stupid pie-in-the-sky stuff. This can work. Economically, we don't have to continue the same things that we're doing, and the economy is not going to totally collapse and fall apart. I think this adds some credibility to what we have to say in the book.
Now, is it true that 80 years ago, the Kellogg Company had a 30-hour work week?
They started it in 1930, so what's that, 71 years ago. They went to a 30-hour work week, six hours a day, 5 days a week. And in parts of the Kellogg Company, that continued until 1985. There was still about a quarter of Kellogg's employees working a 30-hour work week in 1985 when Kellogg's finally said they wanted to stop it and forced the workers to go to 40 hours. The remaining workers had a funeral for the 30-hour week. And I went to Battle Creek, Michigan, and interviewed quite a number of them. And they talk about that time as a really special time when they had the 30-hour work week and said they didn't necessarily miss the extra money. What they liked was the time they had for the community and family. And all of them said that in 1985, when Kellogg's went back to the 40-hour week, crime went up, household abuse went up, all kinds of negative factors in the community went up as a result. So I think it can be done. The sticking point is benefits. That's what it was for Kellogg. They simply found that as benefits became a bigger part of the salary package, that it was cheaper to hire fewer people and make them work longer hours. But I think benefits can be prorated. I think if we also had a national health care system, then that wouldn't be so big a part of the salary package for each individual company. I think we can solve these things. One of the things that few people know is that we almost had a 30-hour work week as national policy in this country in 1933. On April 4th, 1933, the U.S. Senate actually passed a bill that would have made 30 hours the official work week in the U.S., and anything beyond that would have been overtime. Failed in the House of Representatives by only a few votes. Now we're 68 years later, and we still can't get there.
Now, was FDR for that or against it?
FDR flip-flopped quite a bit on that one. He was initially for it. Then, I think, with business pressure, he turned against it. And I'm told that later on in his life, he confided to associates that he thought he had made a mistake in turning against it and that it would have been a good idea. But he opposed it when the House finally voted on it and decided that the answer to unemployment was public works programs of the New Deal rather than shorter working hours.
I can just picture listeners out there hearing this and saying, wow, a six-hour day, that would have been so great. Because I think happy workers are productive workers, and I'm guessing a lot of people could get as much done in 6 hours as they would in eight because they would be more rested.
Well, you know, Kellogg's found that out. What the Kellogg Company did was, W.K. Kellogg was kind of a welfare capitalist. He ran things with a kind of an iron hand, but he really believed in leisure for his workers, and he also built things in the community, parks and libraries and things that people could use their leisure time for. And what Kellogg did was, when he went to a 30-hour work week, he said, you're going to work 30 hours a week, I'm going to pay you for 35. So we're going to each take, we're going to share this, the economic part of it. You won't get paid what you got paid for 40, but I won't cut you down to 30, I'll give you 35. Now, he found that their productivity increased so much per worker that within a couple of years, he could actually pay them what he had paid them for 40 hours before, and it was still profitable. So you're right. Many people find that with shorter hours, and not only does productivity increase, but absenteeism, for instance, goes down appreciably. Health problems decline appreciably, and that affects health care benefits. I mean, there are many. It's a rippling effect that has positive impacts throughout the system.
Now, John, as a television producer and an author, you have a pretty good understanding of the power of the media and the various mediums within advertising, billboards, television commercials. We're raising a whole crop of little consumers, aren't we?
Well, we certainly are, and I think Americans, polls show, are very concerned about how materialistic their kids are. They have reason for concern because children are the primary target, the most important single target now of marketers who are throwing an awful lot of money into reaching these kids and what they call branding them, capturing, owning them before the kids turn 18. So this is an industry that's gone from something like $100 million a year in 1980 to about $2 billion a year now, trying to reach these kids and get them to be big spenders. In our chap, we call the symptom dilated pupils as a symptom of affluenza, and this is our chapter about kids and marketing targeting children. I think it's a form of child abuse, especially when kids are under 10 years old and really can't differentiate between advertisements and real programs. And in many countries, it's not allowed. For instance, in Sweden, you can't advertise to kids under 12. It's just not considered acceptable. You can't do it in the province of Quebec. We considered this back in the 70s in this country, but the power of industry was too powerful, and Congress backed down in its efforts to kind of control marketing to kids. So now the marketers say that kids are just customers, consumers in training, and that's what the ads are for, to train the kids to be good consumers in the American economy.
And so many of the ads have a sexual component, even ones with young kids.
Well, absolutely. A sexual and a violent and aggressive component. I think both of those things are the case. And marketers, for instance, find that promoting rebellion, faux rebellion among kids is kind of a way to get kids to buy things. And so there's sort of a push for kind of an aggressive behavior pattern. And they even talk about that, kind of getting the kids to just be, consider their parents and their adult guardians and teachers to sort of be idiots, this is kind of the message in these commercials.
There are so many psychological and emotional components here. We have people who actually get a high from shopping, from buying, from being acquisitive, from spending that money, from pulling out that credit card. It actually makes them feel good. And you also take a look at cyber sex, which is one of the more bizarre parts of this, and you quote Woody Allen, where the mother catches the son in the act of fantasy sex and says, "Don't do that, you'll go blind," she screams, and he says, "Can I do it until I need glasses?"
Yeah, I guess that's sort of the approach here. I mean, we do have, you know, the companies have batteries of psychologists who are kind of always studying kids and trying to go into the kids' homes and figure out how to reach these kids and to sell them stuff. And then we also have, as you say, a lot of us get a high. And I think to some degree, we all get a little bit of a high from getting new things. The thing is, it just wears off very rapidly, and it wears off much more rapidly the more we have and the more we buy. And you'd think that would tell us something. You'd think that would make us ask the question, this material stuff really make me happy? Is it valuable? Is it cost effective? But instead, what we tend to do is just buy faster. We just think, you know, it only works for a shorter amount of time, so therefore you need more faster and faster in order to keep the high. And I think that's the problem. And this virus, this affluenza, has become an addiction in our society. What we hope is that people will just begin seriously to think about these things, to ask the kind of questions that we ask in the book, and we hope that we'll have a national dialogue about this spending and consumer binge that we've all been on, which is leading to huge rates of bankruptcy in the United States. More and more Americans go bankrupt each year than graduate from college, for example. I mean, it's a mess, and what we want in the book is not, people don't need necessarily to agree with us on everything. We just want them to get to begin talking about this.
Now, John, when you finished the book, which was late last year, we were still riding the wave of the churning economy at the very end of the Clinton administration, and you had a little note in the book somewhere where you said, when this book comes out, you know, the economy could be going down then, and now this just seems like such a crucial time for our country. We have so many people who are worried about the economy. Consumer confidence is plummeting. Yet you point out countries, I believe Norway, Holland, and some others, where people don't worry about the economy, and the economy seems to be doing okay.
Yeah, I'm not going to say they don't worry about it at all, but they're not nearly as obsessed with the amount of growth. Even the former Dutch Prime Minister Ruud Lubbers, who was a conservative, said that, you know, we're not obsessed with economic growth. We don't think that that's necessarily the most important thing. We think time is important, and we think other values of community are important, and the Dutch people accept this, that our growth rate is going to be lower, and we think we're healthier as a result. I could never imagine an American politician saying that sort of thing, but it's common in Western Europe, where people enjoy far greater vacation time, shorter working hours, have more time for all the kinds of things that we as Americans say we value. So, you know, I think we need to stop being so insular and actually see what other countries are doing. And one of the things is that since these terribly tragic events of September 11th, I think maybe more people are stopping and reflecting and asking, you know, what's really important to them. I mean, if I were to, my life were to come suddenly to an end, what would I want? What would have meant something? You know, more time at the office, more consuming of stuff, or the relationships that I had with my family and my friends. And
how would you be remembered? Yeah.
Yeah, how would you be, and what's important? And if we're having a little of that reassessment, I think it's valuable. Also, and in no sense do I want to give the idea that I blame the United States for what happens or that happened, or that I consider this in any sense justifiable, this act, but if we want to prevent these kinds of things from happening in the future, I think we do have to consider the fact that the imbalance in the world between the amount we consume, 4% of the world's population consuming 25% of the resources each year, and what the poor of the world have, and the growing imbalance, is going to lead to more animosity, more hatreds, and probably more terrorism. We can't simply solve this by military means. We have to change the circumstances in the world that breed this kind of thing.
So you're talking about more of a sense of fairness and equity.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I read was that, for example, the World Food and Agriculture Organization says that it would require about a $13 billion a year commitment to end hunger in the world by the year 2015. That's something like less than 10% of the amount of the recent tax cut that we Americans got. I think we as a country need to start making some of those commitments. We think we're very generous, and in some cases we are. And when people, you know, people see suffering like happened in New York, our American generosity comes out, and it's a great thing, and it's good to see. But when pollsters ask people, for instance, about foreign aid, they say, are we giving too much foreign aid? And the majority of people say, yes, we are. And then they say, well, how much foreign aid do you think we're giving as a proportion of the GNP? And people say, or of the federal budget? And people say, well, about 15%. And they say, well, what should we be giving? What would be better? And people say, well, about 5% would be about right. In fact, the real figure is less than 1%. Something like 0.7% of our federal budget goes to foreign aid to help, you know, change some of the things around the world that breed poverty and resentment toward us. We're the tightwads of the industrial world in the sense of what we get given foreign aid, much less than what the Western Europeans do.
My guest is John DeGraff. The book is Affluenza, the All-Consuming Epidemic. I read the New York Times every day, and they've been doing an extraordinary job covering the aftermath of the tragedy on September 11th. And every day for the past couple of weeks, they've been running little biographies of some of the people who died. And they show photos, and they talk about these people and their lives and their loved ones and give you that human connection. Every one of them, they look for the good about them, the kindness, the good things they did. And not in any one of those capsule biographies have I seen they owned a lot of stuff.
Well, I mean, I think it's great, and I've seen those things in the New York Times myself, and I think that's great, and that is what people become, will be remembered by, for, you know, what they contributed to the world and to others, how they used their gifts in the service of others. I dedicate the book to David Brower, the famous environmentalist who died last year at the age of 88, and who was a friend of mine for many years, a man I had tremendous respect for. He's kind of my hero. I saw him 5 days before he died in his hospital bed in Berkeley, California. And before I left, and I knew that things looked bad, and I said, David, I said, well, I hope the next time I see you, you'll be healthy again and back to doing the things you've always been doing. And he looked me in the eye, and he said, John, he said, I don't think that's in the cards, but it's been a great 88 years. And I think this is the issue for all of us to think about is, will we be able to say that when our time comes, that, you know, we really feel our lives have meant something?
Well, on that note, John, I'd like to thank you for your time.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate talking with you.
The book is Affluenza, the All-Consuming Epidemic. My guest has been John DeGraff. He wrote it with David Wan and Thomas Naylor. It's published by Barrett Kohler Publishers out of San Francisco. And they do have a website. It's bkconnection.com. And John, I wish you a lot of luck with all your future endeavors.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much, and glad to be on your program.
And that was John DeGraff. Going back 25 years to his book, Affluenza, it's still in print. It was a bestseller, translated into 9 languages. He sold over 160,000 copies of it. And I was given out a website during that interview, which is probably defunct now, but he still has a very active website. It's johndegraff.com, and his name is spelled D-E-G-R-A-A-F. He's made 12 PBS specials. He still makes documentary films. And at the end of that interview, we were talking about foreign aid and how 25 years ago, a lot of Americans had the perception that we were given too much foreign aid to other countries. And of course, now we're given even less. But the perception was wrong then. We only gave 0.7% of our, whatever you want to call it, economic numbers to foreign aid. And now, with the cutbacks in foreign aid under this current administration, it's much less. And back then, 25 years ago, we were considered the tightwads of the Western world. Well, look at us now. Tune in tomorrow at 10:30 in the morning when Keith O'Brien returns to the program. You might recall Keith was on the show a few years ago for his biography of Pete Rose, Charlie Hustle. Well, he's just now publishing a biography of the basketball star Larry Bird, a product of rural Indiana, went on to star for the Boston Celtics, A Forgotten Place, An Impossible Dream, and The Miracle of Larry Bird. The book is Heartland by Keith O'Brien, and he's going to be coming through next week on book tour, Columbus and Cincinnati. He's also going to be in Terre Haute, where the magic happened at Indiana State when Larry was in college. And you might remember that 1979 basketball game, NCAA final game between Michigan State and Magic Johnson and Larry Bird's Indiana State Sycamores. And wow, do you remember what you were doing? Were you watching that game? 50 million Americans watched it. It was a record back in 1979. And now we call it March Madness. It's coming up tomorrow morning at 10:30. Larry Bird, Heartland. Were you a Celtics fan? Were you an Indiana State fan? I have an Indiana State jersey, and on the back it says Bird. That's coming up tomorrow. Thanks for listening.